Some of the star Viking objects from East Anglia are on display at the Vikings exhibition running at Norwich Castle Museum, alongside the treasures held by the British Museum and the York Museum Trust. To find out more about the Vikings in our region and why Norfolk yields such a surprising number of treasures, I spoke to Senior Curator of Archaeology, Dr. Tim Pestle, in his office adjacent to Castle Meadow, and I took the opportunity to speak to Anna McCarthy, Visitor Programme Manager, about how their events and activities help visitors make the most of the exhibition. I'm here today at Norwich Castle Museum talking to Dr. Tim Pestle, who's the Senior Curator of Archaeology here. And we're here to find out about the Vikings, as you've got an exhibition, Viking Rediscover the Legend, on. This, I understand, is a partnership exhibition?
That's right, it's York Museum's Trust and the British Museum.
Yes.
It's an exhibition that's been deliberately put together to tour. So it started off in York and it then went to Southport, and then on to Nottingham, and finally we're the last stop on the tour, and it ends with us here in Norwich.
Okay. And we've got all sorts of finds here to add to the collection.
We're very, very lucky, because East Anglia is one of those areas that was particularly rich in Viking settlement and activity. Maybe not particularly rich in it if you're an East Anglian at the time, but it does mean that as a result we've got a lot of good Viking archaeology here in Norfolk. And so it was a very logical decision, really, to bring the exhibition here as well.
So can you tell me about the star exhibits? It's always nice to know what's going to be shown.
Yes, the exhibition, because it's done with the British Museum and York Museum in partnership, means that it's got some of the most iconic Viking objects ever found in Britain. So it's got, for instance, the Curdale hoard, which is a fantastic silver hoard, really, that was found in the 19th century, most of which is in the British Museum. The Vale of York hoard that was found by a metal detectorist in the 2000s rather than 1990s. The York helmet, the Ormside bowl, the Beedale hoard, another fantastic Viking hoard, the Gilling sword, the Poppleton hoard. So, yes, they're names which for archaeologists will reel off the tongue, but maybe for the wider public they might recognise these things even if they don't recognise the names.
Exactly. And there are finds in East Anglia as well.
Yes, one of the pleasures for me, and perhaps slight embarrassments, is that there is a lot of material coming up in East Anglia the whole time, and we've actually got a number of acquisitions that haven't quite made it to permanent display yet. Not because we don't want to put them, but because we haven't really had the time or money to do so. But that means that they're all finally out, most of them for the first time ever, in the Viking exhibition.
That's really exciting, isn't it?
It's lovely. It's wonderful for me. It's fantastic to be able to get them out and show them off to people.
Yes, and as we go through, find out more about what's going on in East Anglia with the Vikings. So what period does it cover, and what were people up to when they were thinking about invading?
Well, the Viking period traditionally starts in 793, and that's when we have a record in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle that the Vikings came, or the heathen came, to Lindisfarne and raided the island and the monastery. And it was obviously a sort of deep psychological blow, and so that's why it was mentioned in the chronicle to start with. Less often mentioned is the fact that the next year, 794, the Vikings come back again, and in that year they raided Jarrow, which again had a very wealthy and quite famous monastery where the Venerable Bede used to live. And it really shows how the Viking period is one of mixed conflicting fortunes, because in that year one of the Viking leaders is killed. So obviously they didn't just do a hit and run raid, they were engaged in battle, and this Viking leader died, and it mentions that several of their ships were lost in a storm and that several men were washed ashore, and the Anglo-Saxons gave no quarter and they slew them as soon as they washed up. So raiding was actually not an easy thing. You could leave yourself liable if you got over the ocean in the first place, lead to battle where you might get killed. So that's the start of the Viking Age, and it's always a sort of high-risk strategy. And then it moves in several different phases. And in England, we see two Viking ages. So the first Viking age traditionally ends at about 754, when the Viking kingdom of York fell. And then a second Viking age begins in about the 980s, when there's renewed Viking raiding. And that goes on until there's a full-scale Viking invasion. And ultimately, King Canute, a Danish king, takes the throne of England in 1016. And it ends with the end of the last Viking or Scandinavian raids in the wake of the Norman conquest of 1066. So that's your broad range. You've got 793 to about 1066 or 1100.
So can you just tell me how the Vikings helped reshape Britain, their sort of social impact?
What is it about the Vikings that makes them so, I guess, important for the history, cultural history of Britain as well?
Yes.
And really, the first thing that makes the Vikings distinctive is their use of ships. It means that they're great mariners and they are able to get all over the place really quite quickly. You know, if you've got muddy old roads and a horse pulling a cart, it's much easier in many ways to get to Copenhagen by ship than it is to slog your way down to London. And this means that the seas are highways and they open up. And it also means that the Vikings get everywhere. So it's not just in England where they come raiding, but they go all the way through the north of Scotland, the Northern Isles, the Western Isles, Shetland, Orkney. They all become settled by Vikings. They go all the way round into the Irish Sea. They form another kingdom in Dublin. They have camps in Lancashire, Cheshire, Wales. So the Vikings are getting all over the place, and it's not just here, it's the continent as well. They're doing a lot of raiding there. But of course they settle, and when they settle down, they're bringing a foreign Scandinavian culture with them, and in particular a new language. And so we can see that in the everyday places that we live in. So in Norfolk in particular, the Flegg hundreds are very, very well known. So we've got Scrapby, Ormsby, Philby, Mortby, Oby, Rollsby, all those other BY names that really indicate that there's something different, something distinctive about these areas that were settled by Scandinavian people, and that the Scandinavian language is strong enough not only for them to give their own names to these places, but for the English to accept these names and to use them as well. So that's really, I think, the real distinctive element. And obviously at the time, it means that you've got new peoples coming in with new ways of doing things and living.
So did it work the other way as well, that there was an influence on the Vikings?
Yes, there is. And the most fundamental influence upon the Vikings is Christianity. Because when the Vikings first appear, they are pagans. When they settle down, it's very clear that they quickly adopt Christianity. And in turn, because there's ongoing connection between the Scandinavian homelands and these newly Christianized people, the influence of Christianity begins to tell. And so when the Viking homelands, if you like, become more centralized into nation states rather than loose, smaller kingdoms, they too adopt Christianity.
And can you tell me something about, you mentioned King Canute, who reigned, and his link with Bury St Edmunds?
Well, Canute is linked not only with Bury St Edmunds, but with St Bennet's Abbey at Holme St Bennet's, because according to tradition, and one of the problems that we have is that our historical sources are not always very clear, and they're often much, much later, is that the Benedictine community that occupy Bury St Edmunds actually comes from St Bennet's Abbey in Norfolk. And we have evidence for the cult of St Edmund after he's martyred by the Vikings in 869 through the appearance of coins which hail him as a saint. They say literally St Edmund or O St Edmund on them, and it indicates that there's Christianity going on in the region, even when the pagan Vikings are initially in charge, and that a cult site dedicated to Edmund is built up around a place called Beatrixworth, which we know as Bury St Edmunds. and that ultimately a community of Benedictine monks becomes founded there. Now, this is an important distinction, because when you first encounter a lot of religious life in the Anglo-Saxon period, they're not Benedictine monks as we know it from the medieval period. They're communities of priests. And these priests can often marry, and so they have children, and so their landholdings that are part of the church go to their sons. And so these so-called prebends mean that you've got basically familial churches, that churches that can be basically run by groups of families. And the Benedictines sweep all of this away, because they take on vows of poverty and chastity, and that means that firstly they can't marry, so they don't have any sons to pass the land to. But also it means that the community as a whole is run in a very, very different way, and so the community owns the land. So when Canute puts in a Benedictine abbey here, it's one that owes its, if you like, landholding and its wealth ultimately to the crown, to him, rather than to themselves. And so it's a very big difference. And this seems to happen in the 1020s, and it's quite possibly something that helps him to ingratiate himself in English society. So he's a Danish king, although he is Christian when he comes over. He's basically knocking over a new kingdom, and when he takes it over, he wants to ingratiate himself not only with the English so they don't rebel against him, but also as a monarch on the European stage. And so one of the ways that you can do that is by establishing religious houses to show what a great pious ruler you are yourself. So that's what he does at Bury St Edmunds.
Thank you. So could you give me a little bit of information about the finds from East Anglia?
Mm.
Because I think some of them interpret...
They do. They illustrate the Viking world, and in particular the role or the place of the Scandinavians in Norfolk. Mm. And it's been very, very interesting as a curator at the museum, seeing the new finds come in and how our picture of Viking life has changed over the years as this new evidence has emerged. So, for instance, we've got two hoards of coins that belong to St Edmund, or to King Edmund before he becomes sainted. In other words, these are hoards that were put into the ground while Edmund was still King of East Anglia. And because we've got the particular association of St Edmund with Bury, it's perhaps something that's easy to forget that he's actually King of Norfolk as well as Suffolk, but we probably didn't know of Norfolk, the North Folk and the South Folk, as separated at the time, but that we were all East Anglians. The kingdom was of the East Anglians. And these hoards are very interesting, because the first hoard was found in Wallington in Suffolk, and it's now a very small hoard. It's only 7 pennies. Apparently there were more, but the detectorist who found the first lot never reported them, and so they were, if you like, illegally sold. However, the hoard that we do have, the remains of, tells us that the moneyers that were making those coins come from the middle of Edmund's reign, and that means that it might relate to the way that the Vikings arrived in East Anglia in about 865 AD. And that suggests that somebody local was a bit worried about this sort of hairy mob arriving and stuck them in the ground. Whereas a second hoard that we've got, which comes from Hingham near Wyndham, seemed to have moneyers dating to the end of Edmund's reign. And that might relate to the Vikings coming back to East Anglia in 869. And of course, that's the date that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle tells us that they overwinter in Thetford and they kill the king. And we know virtually nothing more than that. But the coins are a mixed bunch, 23 pennies of Edmund, lots of different moneyers, and that suggests that